about now? Gotta be sure and do that for our tape squatters. That's what we call them. If you would go to a Bible class and just listen to tapes, we call them tape squatters. But you got to make sure you keep the tape squatters happy. Okay, we're looking at verses 22 through 26 here about the return trip to Bethsaida and Jesus' actions here with respect to this blind man that was brought to him. We left off here with point 12, the use of a similar verb to the one used in verse 22 would suggest that the man had not been transported, carried by Jesus to others, as much as they likely led him as one normally led a blind person. And again, this may have implied that he placed some weight on them, you know, they supported his arms or whatever, but it would appear that he was mobile, certainly. And so I wouldn't read Pharaoh here and take it at its firmest sense of meaning to bear or carry, it appears. Because, again, it's you choose later when Jesus takes him aside, taking the man by the hand, Pharaoh led him out. Well, 13, the fact that Jesus touches the blind man and no actual healing occurs should cause the reader to understand that healings were not simply based on the making of contact with Jesus. 5:31, we saw that previously, that this was where the woman had touched him who had the flow of blood and had been healed. And Jesus, you know, complains about, you know, essentially, who touched me? And the disciples said, you see the crowd pressing in on you. And the answer, I mean, they don't come out and say it, but the sense of it is, lots of people have touched you. So that's kind of where they were that day. So a lot of people touched Jesus. And healing isn't just based on making contact with Jesus. And as we know, as time has gone on, Jesus has become more, not that he doesn't still do things indiscriminately, but he's become more insistent on people exercising faith and demonstrating faith in the matter. And he even, of course, we saw the reward, the great reward that came to that woman up there in the region of Tyre, who Jesus insulted, and she got what she wanted out of him because of her great faith. And Jesus responds to faith. So 14, as his ministry has progressed, Jesus has seemed to stop healing indiscriminately, as he apparently had earlier in his ministry. Now his healings involve the volition of the individual and some measure of faith and the willingness of Jesus to provide healing. It appears that, again, during this time, there's not a lot of miracles or teaching mentioned, but I don't presume that they weren't going on at some level. I mean, here we have clearly, very clearly, a specific miracle. But Jesus has spent several months in the regions outside of Galilee in strict Gentile territory. And so, again, while not a lot is recorded during this time, I would assume they were happening at least sporadically, and that there was some teaching, again, being done, although it's not his emphasis. 15, Jesus takes the initiative and leads the man away from those that brought him, which is designed to reinforce the truth that his healing is going to be based on the personal interaction with Jesus and not based on his friend's activity. That's one reason for separating him from those that brought him, was that the man could ostensibly think, well, Jesus is doing this because of them. And Jesus wants to, number one, make it very plain that it's not their faith that is going to affect this cure, that it's him personally. 16, as with the previous miracle, we are not told exactly why Jesus removes the man from those around him. However, Jesus still has a great desire to avoid undue publicity and would want to minimize public scrutiny. And that seems to be the biggest reason, because why does he tell the man not to go back into the village? He doesn't want the man broadcasting this. He doesn't want the man stirring up a bunch of people and getting them all riled up to jump on the Jesus train. That's not what Jesus is looking for. So 17, some have noticed that it seems unusual that Mark refers to Bethsaida as a village in verse 33. Since it had been recently elevated to the status of a fortified city by Herod Philip in approximately 30 AD. And at this point, we're in 32 AD. So a couple of years after that. 18, however, there are at least three potential explanations as to why Mark would have referred to Bethsaida as a village. The first is that Jesus did not enter the city proper, but was actually in an outlying village. That, to me, doesn't really fully wash, because when you look, you look in verse 27, the next one up, Jesus went out along with his disciple to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And so this implies a number of smaller settlements that are situated around or a part of a greater city. And that, of course, is one thing. But it says in verse 22, they came into Bethsaida. And that would tend to imply motion into the city itself. The second, which Lane suggests, is that despite its new status, Bethsaida essentially remained a large village in reality. And see, the third is that Peter had likely been familiar with the village since his youth. So he may have referred to it as a village, since this is the way he had always viewed it. And the reality is, of course, that this is Peter's recollections as recorded by Mark. And so how Peter thought of the thing is germane to this, because, I mean, when people talk about, well, the same's even true here. You talk about, okay, well, where'd you go on vacation? People say, I went to Sarasota. Well, many of them never stay in the city of Sarasota because it's a relatively small place. But there's obviously many outlying regions, and people consider that they live in Sarasota even if they're east of 75. Well, the city limits stop, back around McIntosh or somewhere. I don't remember exactly where they are, but they're somewhere in there. So, again, you have all these possibilities. So, to impute, and the only reason I cite all this is because critics want to make a big deal out of this. And it's another one of those things that's not a big deal. There's a lot of explanations as to why he calls it this, and to my thinking. And it may be a combination of all the above. So, 19, in any case, it would be incorrect to impute error to Mark, who would be writing based on Peter's understanding of the situation. And again, just because it had been elevated to the status of the city didn't mean it had been materially made a lot bigger. So, it does, again, the village might be still a very good definition for it. Well, 20, as with the previous miracle, Jesus uses saliva to effect the cure. The use of saliva in healings was not uncommon in the ancient world, and there are several accounts of saliva being used to cure blindness particularly. 21, in his commentary on Mark, Gundry cites a number of ancient sources that indicate that saliva was often used enough in magic and medicine that people would not have been necessarily shocked by Jesus' action. Today, yeah, they would have been shocked. But that's where the cultural differences come into play. Jesus is not here flouting cultural norms and standards. He's acting in a manner that's not shocking or surprising to these people that see it. And the fact is, depending upon how far away he moved from these people, nobody may have seen him do it other than the guy himself. And clearly he didn't see it at first, but he would have been aware of it. So, this is something that was pretty common at that time in history and wouldn't have been looked at as being weird. So, 22, obviously Jesus could have healed the man with a single command. Nevertheless, the fact that Jesus makes personal contact is designed to make it explicit that he alone is the source of the man's restored sight. Separating from his friends and, making this a one-on-one situation with Jesus alone really forces the man to one conclusion and one conclusion only. It was Jesus and Jesus alone that healed me. And that is the good reason for why he does it this way. In 23, additionally, there is the very personal element in all of this, which is designed to reinforce the concept that salvation and other blessings are the result of a personal interaction with Jesus Christ. And the fact is, like the other guy, when he pulls him aside away from the crowd, there may have been something in the man's demeanor. We don't have all the particulars. The person may have been frightened. They may have, there's a number of reasons why Jesus might have done what he did. But certainly, the personal interaction and then being alone forces the man to the conclusion that it was all that happens to me, and essentially, because he is going to get his sight back, that all of this is the basis, was done on the basis of Jesus and Jesus alone. There's no other explanation for this. But because these things were done this way, this is what one of the reasons why many people thought Jesus was just a local magician. That he was the kind of guy, like sort of like that guy there in Acts, the Simon Magus character who ran around and astonished people with his little magic tricks. And so in this case, and this was one of the charges against Jesus, that he was involved with the occult and or magic because of the way he did things. So 24, Mark uses a very rare word to describe the man's eyes in verse 23. The Greek term oma is used of the eye as the medium of perceptions, perception. 25, the word is used more in poetic writings and is only used twice in the New Testament. In this case, it is used to focus the reader on the gradual perception the man gains as Jesus works with him. Now, what could this be teaching us? People learning gradually, huh? People that can't really see what's going on around them. This could be like the disciples, couldn't it? Yeah. This is an object lesson in what the disciples were experiencing spiritually. This man experienced physically, and it's a picture, as it were, of what the disciples are going through. Well, 26, there is clearly spiritual significance here demonstrated by the interaction between Jesus and the blind man, which parallels the gradual perception of the apostles as to Jesus' true identity. And again, it's not going to come on them quick. But after the resurrection, when their eyes really get open, all these things that happened previously come to have the significance that they were meant to have in the first place. But when they look back, then they're going to see everything clearly. But not until that point. And until they're alone with Jesus and have oriented to Him, they're still going to be, as it were, in the dark, just like this guy. And so the personal work with this man also very much parallels the personal work that Jesus puts in with people. That's the issue within discipleship, is that it is a long, a tedious, a messy business. Because if you're going to, as it were, disciple someone, and which this is what ultimately Christianity is really about, and that's going to come up loud and clear at the end of the chapter. If you look at the end of beginning at verse 34, he starts to spell out, if anyone wishes to come after me, i.e. if anyone wishes to follow me as a disciple, that's what he's talking about. There are many people who think they want to follow Jesus. And many people give lip service. Oh, I follow Jesus, yeah. I like it, I can tell you do, because you got a bumper sticker with a fish on it. as you're tailgating and speeding down the road, you're a disciple of Jesus. I know this. That's two of my pet peeves, is tailgating and speeding. I have become, there was a song by a guy named Ian Hunter, I have become what I hated when I was young. Well, that's what's going to happen. Yeah, look at me, guys, because this is where you're headed. It's frightening, isn't it? You think, oh, no, I'll never be that way. We'll see. We'll see. 27, following the action of spitting into the eyes of the blind man, Jesus places his hand upon the blind man's eyes. Although that is not specifically recorded here, the use of the adverb palin, in verse 25 indicates that Jesus had placed his hands on the man's eyes previously. And 28, there is nothing particularly unusual in the incident to this point, since Jesus has acted in this same manner on previous occasions. I mean, there's been occasions where he took the person aside. There's been occasions where he made contact. We had invocations, we have at least one, but I would presume these were, again, all part of a larger body of miracles that these guys drew from when they were writing their accounts, where he's used saliva. So in one sense, there's nothing new here. However, point 29, at the end of verse 23, several significant differences are observed. There are at least three elements that have no parallel in any of the other healings of Jesus. 30, the first is that Jesus asked the man if his actions had been effective, which was likely designed to get the man to focus on the signals his brain was now receiving from his eyes. Now, we don't know what the problem was, but one would suspect that it had to be some sort of nerve issue, because he wasn't receiving the nerve impulse. The nerve impulses weren't being transmitted to his brain, and so he could get no pictures. But whatever it was, The fact is, Jesus needs to kind of get him focused on, is this working? Because he's got to start thinking, as it were, in a different way. I mean, his mind is, but he had seen before, as we pointed out. He wasn't born blind. So, but was he really conscious the second the light started to come into his eyes? He may not have been, and so that would very well explain why Jesus asked him that. Well, 31, although the form of the question is unusual in the Greek, it is simply a direct question that is introduced by the hypothetical particle. Oh, I think in the notes, I think I said that was indirect. It's supposed to be a direct question. When he taking, he said, do you see anything? If anything, do you see? Yeah, it's a direct question. Do you see anything? So essentially, we might translate it, he asked him if he saw anything, would be more the way we might phrase it today. So I, this hypothetical particle, which is used more regularly to introduce indirect questions. For instance, it's used in Mark 15:44 that way. And normally, this is the way it is used. Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time. Well, there the indirect question, the direct thought was, is he dead? But the indirect thought was he wondered if he was dead. And so that's normally the way I is used. So that's different. 32, the translation of the first part of verse 24 in the New American Standard is somewhat misleading. Since the verb anablepo can mean to raise the eyes, but it can also mean to regain vision. Mark 10:51-52. And answering him, Jesus said, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man said to him, "Rabboni, I want to regain my sight." And Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has made you well." Immediately he regained his sight and began following him on the road. And that's what anablepo means, is to see again. More normally, that's one that. But it also again does mean to look up as well. So ana, the preposition has the spatial deal of up, as opposed to down. So 33. In this case, France notes that the dual use of the verb to look up and see again is effectively exploited. The man looked up and reported on the result of his attempt, which was that he could see again, even though not yet perfectly. In 34, it is evident that the man's vision has been restored, since he acknowledges as much in his rather choppy response, which was likely the result of his excitement at what was taking place. I would presume here the Greek of verse 24 is relatively choppy, but I think it's choppy because it kind of expresses the way the guy would have talked. And Peter would have noticed, assuming he was within earshot, that the guy says, and he looked up, or having looked up, or having seen again, and again, the verb means both things, he was saying, "I see the men, that as trees, I perceive them walking around." Well, that's a rather convoluted way to state what he's trying to say, but it probably has to do with the fact that this is mind-blowing, as you would expect. I mean, if you were blind and then suddenly you could see, you're probably going to be a little bit at a loss for words. And I think that's why it's expressed this way in the Greek. The guy probably was at a loss for words. I wouldn't be surprised at all. So 35, he immediately acknowledges the fact that he can see. The fact that he saw men walking around like trees indicates that his eyes now admitted light. But something was still not functioning correctly. And 36, the fact that the man states this in this way indicates that he had not been born blind, since he would not have had any idea what a man or tree would look like if such had been the case. And essentially, I presume what he means by "I see men as trees walking around," that he just saw a torso and could make out no distinction of like arms and head, and it was just very blurry, just looked like essentially a tree. Then that was it. 37, since he knew what a tree looked like and the relative size a man should be, he could make a logical connection within his mind when he observed men moving around him, since he would have known that trees did not move. That much he would have known. But this, again, presumes that he had seen before, which I think has to be the presumption here. We're not specifically told. Now, there is a healing in John 9 in which a man was born blind, but that's very explicit that he was born blind and hadn't seen at all. Well, 38, therefore, the man could see what was in front of him, but he could not see it clearly. This certainly parallels the spiritual condition of the apostles, who believe Jesus to be the Messiah, but do not yet recognize him as God in the flesh. And they make that plain, you are the Messiah. Peter spells it out, and I don't have any, other than Judas, obviously you always have to know that there's an exception to, you know, to the apostles. But other than Judas, I think Peter's view was expressing the view of all the rest of them too. That he wasn't just speaking off, I mean, Peter could go off on his own, but in this case, I think he's speaking for the group. They're not arguing with this. They believe Jesus to be the Messiah. And 39, this leads to the second unique element in the story. Since this is the only place in the New Testament where Jesus does not provide complete and instantaneous healing. And 40, there is no indication as to why this should be the case, since legions of demons had proven to be no match for the Son of God, and neither should the restoration of sight. And in fact, the man born blind in John 9 had already been healed by this time. That would have predated this. So, then what? Well, 40, again, we can't assume, there's no reason, again, here to assume a lack of power on Jesus' part. That would be the first logical thing. Well, maybe it was more hard than everything else. But all things are equally hard if you're God, or equally easy. I mean, if you're God, you can do anything. Well, 41, however, the reality may be that there was no problem with the healing. The reality may be that the man was having a difficult time with the perception aspect of what was happening. It may be, you know, but why he does it gradually, and certainly he does, and the man's perception is clearly gradual. There's no doubt about it. But was it just something that this healing, you know, was taking some time to complete because of the nature of what was being done? You know, obviously Jesus could have spoken it all instantaneously. And again, he didn't have to touch the guy, didn't have to do anything to heal him if he wanted to. So why is this coming this way? Well, those are the tough questions. And 42, Jesus once again places his hands on the man's eyes, just as he had done in verse 23, which here is the more normal Greek term, ophthalmos, for eyes. And 43, the second touch suggests that the healing of the man's blindness was gradual and was a matter of some difficulty for Jesus. However, again, there is nothing in the text or the incident itself that supplies a complete explanation. One of the things we see that when it comes to demons, when it comes to healings, Jesus appears to have had no trouble before. So either this thing was a particularly hard deal, maybe based on what the problem was, whether there was a problem with the nerves, with the eye itself, with both. We're not really ever told, obviously. I mean, and there's not any sort of medical diagnosis given here other than just he was blind. So people go blind for a lot of reasons, and we don't know why he was. Well, 44, once Jesus lays his hands on the man for the second time, verse 25 makes it explicit that this action provided a complete restoration of the man's sight. And 45, this is the third unique element. Since there is no record of any of Jesus' healings requiring a second action to provide a complete cure. So why here again? 46, the absolute success is emphasized in verse 25 by three expressions that indicate that Jesus had completely restored the man's vision and he could see perfectly. The verb diablepo is a strengthened form of the verb blepo, to see, and means to stare with the eyes wide open and to see things distinctly. That by itself would suggest that the cure was complete. B, the verb apokathistano is defined as changing something into a previous good condition. This indicates nothing less than the complete healing and restoration of the man's eyesight, and again to what we would probably call 20/20 vision, as he saw when he was younger at some point in his life. See, the last verb, emblepo, means to look at something intently. And this is qualified by the adverb pelagos, which means very clearly or plainly. So, and for the final adjective, hapas, the totality of something, indicates that there was nothing that he could not distinguish, no matter how large or small. So he sees, now he sees at a distance, he sees close up, he sees things with detail. There's no problem with his sight whatsoever. That's very clear. 47, Jesus had purposely taken the man away from the village, and the people would have been that would have been assembled there, and now forbids him from returning to the village. And 48, rather, Jesus sends him to his own home. It is evident that the man needed to spend some time to consider what had taken place, and to consider the spiritual issue of exactly who Jesus was. I mean, when these types of things happen, the question that has to be asked is, who is this guy and where did he get this power? I mean, that has to be the first logical question. If somebody did something like this for you, you know, say you're like me, you're blind as a bat, and you can't see at all to speak of. And somebody walks up and touches you and says, I'm going to give you your sight back and you're going to be healed perfectly. And then it happened instantaneously. Even if it took 3 whole minutes like this one did. Well, I would be asking, well, where did you get this power? How'd you do that? And Jesus wasn't, he wasn't running around screaming, I'm the Son of God. He was just letting his actions prove it. I mean, I don't know that he ever, he forbid the demons. He didn't want people being broadcast this information because he knew they had to come to faith in this on their own. And this guy does too. He's got to come at some level. If he does ever come to faith, he's going to have to come to it on his own. It's not going to be because of his friends. It's not going to be anything else other than a one-on-one deal with Jesus. Well, 49, this has puzzled interpreters since there is no real reason that people could not have deduced what had happened. Therefore, it seems likely that Jesus also does this to deflect attention away from him and his disciples. Now, when Jesus goes back into the village, the next logical question those people are going to ask is, where'd he go? And when Jesus says, well, I sent him back to his village, back to his house. Well, logically, wouldn't you assume that the people that brought him would then go follow him? And that takes all the attention, deflects it all off of Jesus and the disciples, and essentially puts it back on the guy. So by sending him away, he does the same thing. By telling him not to talk about it. And that is, it keeps Jesus in a lower position, at least his public perception. So 50, while some versions contain the addition, nor tell anyone in the town, the better manuscripts do not. The point is that the man was to return to his home rather than make the matter public and attract attention. And 51, the restoration of the hearing to the deaf, causing the dumb to speak and giving sight to the blind, were seen as actions of God. Psalm 146:8. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord raises up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. And additionally, these were conditions that were prophesied for the kingdom of Messiah. Isaiah 29:18. And in fact, Jesus is already, in sending back his response earlier to the disciples of John the Baptist, or this was previous to John's beheading, of course, had essentially told people this. Isaiah 29:18. On that day the deaf will hear words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind will see. The afflicted will also increase their gladness in the Lord, and the needy of mankind will rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. And also 35:5. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped, and the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will shout for joy. For waters will break forth in the wilderness and streams in the Arabah. Well, 52, as we will observe, the apostles, except Judas, I try to mention that, but I assume I know that Judas is an unbeliever by now, likely recognize these things. And this will result in the declaration that Jesus is the Christ. That they get. Okay, well, this he's doing the types of things that Messiah, it was thought the Messiah would do. In fact, the things that the Scripture foretold that he would do. And this was the very same answer, again, he gives to John's disciples. Go tell John what? The deaf are hearing, the blind are seeing, and et cetera, et cetera. So 53, however, while this is true, the disciples will still demonstrate the fact that they had incomplete perception. They believe Jesus to be the Messiah, but do not believe him to be God. And 54, this is stressed by Mark. Man, when they had to be present at some of these things. I mean, what did they think when he said, what if you see the Son of Man ascend back where he was before? Where did they think Jesus had been? What did they think he meant when he said, he who comes from above is above all? Above, where'd you come from? That would be the first question. Where did you come from? And the disciples have heard these type of speeches, but they don't get it. They still don't get it. Well, 54, this is stressed by Mark as he has emphasized the disciples' true lack of understanding, for which Jesus has provided sufficient evidence and for which he chastised them. Mark 4:40, he has given them plenty of evidence of who he is. Why are you still afraid? Why do you still have no faith? What is it with you guys? 6:48 through 52. This is when he walks on the water. Now there he had calmed the storm, controlled the weather, the elements. Here he walks on the water. Verse 52 sums it up. They had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves. And of course the incident of the loaves itself is proof that he can create out of nothing. So can you create ex nihilo? Or can you just say, there it is? If you do, make me lunch today. You know, if you can. But people can't do that. And God's the only one, see, from a man's perspective, and science has got this one right, matter can be neither created nor destroyed by man. But God can. He can create and destroy matter. We can't. So 8:17 through 21. The passage we just saw there where he rebukes them about the two healing or the two feedings as to why they didn't get it. And then 9:32 coming up in the following chapter. But they did not understand this statement and they were afraid to ask him. Well, what didn't you get? The Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. What's hard about this? Well, see, that's all they focused on. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. But they did not understand this statement. Why? Well, one of the reasons in their defense, in the doctrine of the resurrection, there was nothing that was ever taught in the Old Testament or that even suggested that resurrection was viewed as anything other than a final event that occurred at the end of time and that everybody was involved. It was a corporate deal. And Jesus is now talking about some kind of resurrection in which he's raised all by himself. Well, that's not in their frame of reference. So to give them slack where we can, there was nothing in the teaching of doctrine to that point other than Jesus' words that would have indicated that Jesus believed in a special resurrection just for himself and nobody else. And that doesn't preclude, however, the understanding that there is a general resurrection at the end of the age. Well, as we now know, this is the beauty of additional revelation, as we now know, there are waves of resurrection. They don't occur all at once. Jesus was the first wave of resurrection. He's called the first fruits for that very reason. And Jesus comes to have first place in all things. Guess what? He's the first one raised from the dead. In fact, he's the only one that's ever been resurrected in human history to this point. The only one. Other people were resuscitated. They came back from the dead. They were raised back. They brought back. But they died anyway. And then, of course, their body went into the grave, decayed. And that's where it is now. And then the next wave of resurrection actually occurs at the rapture. And this fulfills the principle, the first or last, and the last or first. The church age crowd gets its resurrection, and by implication, its rewards, at the Bema Seat. This occurs at a secret meeting in the air. Well, this has been ridiculed to the high heavens. I just saw the deal. I saw an old Saturday Night Live the other day, and they made a joke on there. I survived the rapture. good. When you really survive it, you're not going to think it's so great. I survived the rapture. I lived through Daniel's 70th week. You ain't going to make it. The odds against living through Daniel's 70th week are astronomically against people. I mean, so many people die, it's unbelievable. So the rapture, the church age, then gets their resurrection. And then the final wave of resurrection is the Old Testament crowds and saints, and they're last. And that's alluded to, say, in the book of Hebrews. That God has set us up that we should get ours first, and that they should not be made perfect, as it were, apart from us. And so then there's the Old Testament crowd. There has to be an additional wave of resurrection, I believe, that's not alluded to in the Scriptures. But those who survived Daniel's 70th week, those who went into the millennium, they eventually, at some point, are going to have to get out of their physical bodies. Physical bodies are not immortal. And so you can't have mortality living with immortality forever, I don't believe. I just don't see that that fits. And in fact, he says death will be swallowed up in immortality. So the idea is that immortality will prevail throughout the eternal state. And so I don't see mortal bodies being able to survive all that. Speaking the universe out of existence is going to be real hard on carbon-based life forms. So you better have a different resurrection body. You better have a different body by then, or it's going to be real tough on you. And so these people, again, but this is a relatively small group, but they at some point must be translated as well. And get their resurrection body. So there's really, as we know now, probably four waves of resurrection at least. And they occur at different times. They're not all the same. But Jewish understanding really only dealt with this. This was the only one they thought about. This was the only one they perceived. And this was, in some ways, the only one that their scriptures had taught about. And so they, again, will find out about this. And so they're scared to ask him, why were they afraid to ask him, you think? They didn't want to know. At a certain level, they really don't want to know what's coming. And certain people are like that. They just want to stick their head in the ground and say, well, what's coming? I don't know. I don't care. Just don't want to know. Well, this is where the prophetic word becomes very helpful. And when you go out, you will find some information on your cars. Throw it away immediately. Or read it, whatever, I don't care. But I'm fairly certain that their prophetic view will be lacking. But thank God, we'll have ours. Okay, verse 27 here. Jesus went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. Now again, this is a travel, we don't know how long this took, but they traveled some 25 miles off to the north and slightly to the east of where they had been. And on the way, he questioned his disciples, saying to them, who do people say that I am? And again, you got a chi here that's not translated. They went out as ex-Erchomai, I presume, from that village, E-X-E-R-C-H-O-M-A-I, that village they were in, Bethsaida, or in the suburbs or whatever there. So they went out from there, the Jesus, proper name, and Chi, the disciples, ho mathetes, of him, autos, genitive of the pronoun, into the villages, and here you got a plural, which suggests again that Caesarea Philippi is comprised of abroad, you know, however big, but that there are these individual villages that made up the whole of the place. The villages is Kome again, K-O-M-E. And then you have the noun, Caesarea, which again, the word Caesar comes from this. And this was what Philip had renamed the city. He'd renamed it in honor of Caesar. Caesarea of Philippi. Again, this is a partitive genitive, the villages that were part of that city. The villages which made it up. And in the way, or on the way, preposition N here, plus the word hadas, with the definite article. And this word becomes to have an increasingly important point from this point on in the narrative, and also in terms of the overall understanding of the disciples, because this term means a way, a road, or a path. And it will become a term that's very common among first century believers. And this was how they referred to Christianity, as the way. And this is what they believed. And in fact, they were true, as Jesus will point out to them on the last night. I am the way and the truth and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. And so the way became sort of a, they would use this term sort of as a way of referring to the totality of the Christian experience. The way. And so Jesus walked in, as it were, the way. And the disciples have to walk the same way he walks. And in the same way he walks. If they are going to effectively follow him. So again, here in this context, again, it doesn't mean a whole lot on the way as they were traveling, sort of, which is fine. But this term comes to have, again, a greater influence in Christianity. He was questioning them. Again, epero-ta-o is the verb. This is the one that's a strengthened form and means to question at some length, to question in detail, not just merely to ask a single question. And the fact that it's an imperfect indicates that the question was asked, you know, several times. The disciples is mathetes again here, the disciples of him, his disciples, saying to them. Here's how he questioned them. This is a participle by means of saying to them, likely. Who, you got the interrogative pronoun here, which can mean who, which, or what, but normally if it's neuter, you're going to translate it what or which, but if it's masculine, you're going to translate it like it's a person. Who? And that's what they do here. Who do the people, the men, people in general, this is a term, ho anthropos again, and then the same verb, lego, who are people saying I to be, me to be, literally. And so what you have here is this indirect discourse. The verb I me is actually an infinitive of indirect discourse, and then you have the accusative of general reference. Who do people think me to be is kind of the idea. Who are they saying that I am? And they told him, saying, John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others, one of the prophets. But is actually then they told him, they didn't translate this one either. The duh here is not translated, but again, it would probably be translated in terms of sequence then. Then they told him, they is actually just the definite article in the plural. They themselves said to him, they said, ipon, aorist indicative of the verb eipon, which is the aorist of lego. They said to him, is Jesus, autos again. They told him is the way they've translated all that. By saying that, conjunction hati here introduces the indirect discourse, tells them what the content was of what people were saying. John the Baptist. Again, more properly, John the Baptizer. This is accusative masculine singular of the noun baptistes. Now, Mark tends to use this, baptistes, the noun form, while some will use the participle form of baptizo, one baptizing. Both have the same force, whether you call him one baptizing or a baptizer. Doesn't really materially change the force of it. And others, again, the adjective here, alas, would suggest others of the same kind. There's another word one would use, which would be heteros, which would imply others of a different kind at least. And so the people here are all viewed as one big group that has just different opinions about Jesus. The masses out there. And the John the Baptist identification had become popular after the death of John the Baptist, not before. But again, that death hadn't probably been many, many months in the past. It had probably occurred sometime during that summer, or possibly as early as the spring, but 32 A.D., we would think. And so Herod had fallen into this view. Again, this is not well thought out. Somebody dies and you presume they've come back from the dead to haunt you. That's kind of the view of it. But yet they come back in the form of a real person. I mean, in science fiction, maybe. In the real world, no. This doesn't happen. And again, it's not a well thought out position at all. So some others, they say Elijah. Now, why would he be Elijah? Well, they were all familiar. All the Jews were familiar with the coming of Elijah. They still are. They set an empty place at the Passover Seder. There's always an empty seat for guess who? Elijah. Because Elijah's coming back. That was the view. And that view fundamentally permeated Judaism. That Elijah was coming back. They really had bought into this doctrine. That Elijah was going to return before the great and mighty day of the Lord. Now, the interesting thing is, does it say Elijah's going to come before Messiah? Or does it say before the great and mighty day of the Lord? It talks about the great and terrible day of the Lord. And so here's the problem. You have the entire whole process of the first advent, the forerunner in the first advent, this historical reality that exists in history. And if Messiah is here, and the disciples believe that he is, there's no doubt that they accept him as the Christ. As we will see, the Son of the living God, whatever that meant to them. But certainly they believed that he was the Messiah. This is going to pose a theological problem for them later because Jesus is going to tell them, I'll tell you, Elijah already came, and they did do him what they wanted. And they're sitting there thinking, how did we miss Elijah? Because there's nothing in the Old Testament prophecy that would assume that this was going to be a quiet or some kind of coming that people didn't get. That it says it's going to be very public. He's going to turn the hearts of the children to their parents. There's going to be a very public form of repentance that occurs because of his presence. Well, the disciples are going to end up tied up theologically because they can't reconcile all this. And the fact is, of course, if you didn't see the idea of the first advent and the idea of the second advent as being two completely separate items separated by a long period of time, well, you were going to have real trouble putting this together theologically because you've got these prophecies. Well, okay, so Elijah's coming. Well, some think you're Elijah. Some think you are the prophesied return of Elijah. Now, Jesus has done nothing to make him think that or said anything that would suggest that he is. And when John the Baptist was asked point blank, are you Elijah? He said, I am not. And then later on, Jesus is going to say, and if you can understand it, John the Baptist was Elijah. Well, how can John not know he's Elijah and be Elijah? Well, he's not really Elijah back from the dead. That's easily proven that he's not. But as we know, John went forth in the spirit and power of Elijah. He was a type of Elijah. And in fact, had the first advent worked, and this gets into some really hypotheticals here, had the Jews accepted Jesus, they would have accepted the forerunner, they would have accepted John, and they would have accepted Jesus. What had happened in the angelic conflict had the Jews repented and turned to God en masse? We don't know. The presumption is the kingdom would have been established right then. But we also know that God, via omniscience, knows this isn't going to happen. Jesus knows it isn't going to happen. But yet you still have the situation where the forerunner and the Messiah are here as they're supposed to be. And as we'll find out, of course, Elijah does appear before the great and mighty day of the Lord. He and Moses are going to come back. And they're going to, as we're coming up here, we're going to see it in the next chapter, they're going to meet with Jesus briefly on the mountaintop and have a little discussion. But they're going to be gone. They're going to be there for a few minutes, and then they're going to leave. However long they were there. So others, again, you got a conjunction duh here, Elijah, another conjunction duh, and others that one of the prophets. Again, that hottie here continues the direct discourse. One of the prophets. Now we don't know which one. Pick a prophet, any prophet. Well, maybe Jesus is him. And in a sense, got the numeral heis here for one, and then a prophetes. And so, if he is a prophet, which one is he? And I think the more general sense was that, well, he's not a specific prophet, but he has all the force and power of a prophet. But maybe he's just one of the prophets raised from the dead. Elijah, Jeremiah, Isaiah. Pick one, pick your favorite prophet, and maybe Jesus is him. Well, he's most certainly not, as we're going to see. All right, well, our time's just about gone. I'm not going to dive into this today. We will have that out of the way and be ready to continue on here Tuesday. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.